to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, here with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Well, it was a big weekend for the Local Talk team.
Yep.
Ursula?
That's right. We produced our very first national broadcast right from the studio with a live feed from the Candidates Forum, which was in Des Moines down at the First Christian Church. It was a 3.5-hour show, which went out to other community radio stations over the Pacifica Radio Network. Very exciting.
We talk about the Local Talk team achieving this, but we couldn't have done it without our talented engineers.
That's right. Credit goes to Eric Weber, Paul Nelson, and Richard Morrison for making the day go smoothly. It was a stellar performance. And also you, Greta, and Gail Seiler, and Jim Werbel, you were down there live and really outdid yourselves. And Kay Puttock was here in the studio producing. And everybody really rose to the occasion. It was a great day for KHOI.
Under your great leadership, Ursula. And we'll be sharing that broadcast on our website?
Yeah, we'll put a link on the homepage to parts of it.
And last week was just the beginning of our Iowa caucus coverage and our national broadcasting.
Yep, for the caucus night, we're actually going to fly in a producer from Pacifica Radio Station KPFK in Los Angeles, Alan Minsky. He's going to come and he's going to help us cover the caucuses on the ground for the whole nation. All eyes are on Iowa until February 2nd.
Right. So I just wanted to share a tidbit of Saturday's show for our Local Talk listeners.
Okay.
Both Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders appeared at the candidate forum. Both of them had very fine moments. But here's a snippet of Bernie Sanders responding to a question from the wife of an undocumented worker.
So you got the Trumps of the world trying to divide this country up on racial lines by suggesting our president is not legitimate. And then he comes up with the brilliant idea that all the people coming over from Mexico are criminals and racists and rapists and drug dealers. So we're supposed to hate Mexicans. And then his next brilliant idea is we got to prevent Muslims from coming into this country and we're supposed to hate Muslims. That type of demagoguery has gone on. He didn't invent it. It's gone on for hundreds of years. It's called scapegoating minorities. And we're supposed to hate people because they're a little bit different than we are. Our job is to stand together, to be united, not divided. And with our unity to, in fact, take on the people who are really wrecking the middle class today, and that is not Latinos who are picking tomatoes at $8 an hour. I can tell you that.
That was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders from the CCI Candidate Forum, which was broadcasting live on KHOI and distributed nationally through Pacifica Radio Network. And I'm sure the reaction was so positive in partly because that's what this conference did. It brought people together from different backgrounds.
That's right. There were grassroots groups from Kansas City, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Chicago, even Michigan, telling their stories of disparity and loss. And I say grassroots, but perhaps it should be concrete roots movement. One of the most poignant stories to me was about a kid who grew up in urban St. Louis. And as a youngster, he would travel to the county and just marvel at its greenness. I hope we get to share his story and others later this week on Local Talk, but we've got guests in the studio who are here to talk about just that thing, the importance of green space and, more importantly, natural spaces to our human community, but also to the many biological communities that make up our prairie ecosystem, such as it is here in Iowa. So we have in the studio Lisa Hine, Program and Planning Director of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi, good morning.
And we have Mark Edwards, retired Trails Manager for the Iowa DNR, also involved in coordination and planning of state parks during his tenure at the DNR.
Good morning.
So public lands have been in the news lately in eastern Oregon, where it is day 10 now of the occupation of a federal building by Ammon Bundy and dozens of others to protest the imprisonment of two ranchers who set fire to federal lands to cover up evidence of their poaching. And in all the talk about guns and ammo, a fact that sometimes gets lost is that this 200,000-acre refuge is a bird sanctuary composed largely of wetlands established over 100 years ago by Theodore Roosevelt, and that the reason grazing and hunting on it is strictly limited is so that it can maintain its biological integrity. Furthermore, there were 24,000 registered visitors to this sanctuary in the year 2014, largely birders, because as a bird sanctuary, it tends to attract birds. So we've brought you to here to help us understand why public land is important. And we want to bring the focus, of course, to Iowa and its public lands or preserves. In other words, lands set aside for the purpose of maintaining biological integrity, not so much recreational land. Mark Edwards, your time at the Iowa DNR included a lot of years, not just managing trails, but, as we said, managing the whole state park system. Could you tell us where the state stands in terms of public lands?
Well, but maybe before we get to that, I think this example out in Oregon is a perfect example of the path that we've taken as a nation and how to define public land, and that's still up to discussion and how we use it. So that area in particular was set aside as a bird sanctuary, not only because it's on the flyway, but because they were wiping out the birds pretty much for feathers, for hats.
Yeah, I read
so
that.
It's hard to believe that they actually were wiping them out from that area. So anyway, so that's a good example. So when we take that out there, and a lot of the discussion out there has been about how much public land they have there. And in Iowa, we want to talk about how little we have, I think, because
right.
We're near the very bottom and probably competing on for the very bottom of public land.
And it wasn't always that way?
No, actually, Iowa was transformed so fast within two generations from this prairie state, you know, to a farming state that it was quickly recognized. Iowa State University scientists started realizing the biological diversity just dropping like crazy. And so we decided to set up a state park system. So in the early 1900s, about the same time as this land out in Oregon, we started setting up how we were going to set up a park system. So by the early 1920s and their 1917, say for ledges, for example, we set aside state parks. We did that because we thought we went and surveyed the state in one way and said, what's the best left? And that was our state park system. And so looking at that today, that represents, if we put them all together in one place, that's a square like 9 miles on a side. So it's not very much that we saved under that designation. So we have various other designations for public land, but that's supposedly the cream of the crop and the one that has the most protection besides preserves. We have a small 10,000 acres in preserves.
And then in the 50s, Iowa established the County Conservation Board system. So every county now has a conservation board, and those conservation boards help protect land for public access and public use as well.
So, okay, so there's three levels possible. There's federal, state, and county.
And city and community.
Of course, yeah, the city, for example, City Hall would be public land.
Well, in terms of parks,
And parks too, yeah, of course. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of federal land, we have close to nothing, right, here in Iowa?
Well, we've got the fish and wildlife areas, national fish and wildlife areas, like DeSoto Bend over in western Iowa and up north central Iowa. There's some large wetland areas. We have no national parks in Iowa. We have some national monuments.
Right, the Effigy Mounds and
in the Hoover.
Herbert Hoover. Mm-hmm. And the monuments are historical entities, preserved for historical reasons, whereas the parks are preserved for biological.
And public access, yeah.
Okay, so why is it important for us to preserve public land?
Well, again, we're back to two views, two ways, two dimensions to look at this public land in terms of the purposes that we want to use it for. And we can talk about intrinsic use, which has value in and of itself besides people. And we can talk about instrumental use, which is use, no matter recreation, fishing, hunting, all those kinds of things. And so when you look at the areas that we have in Iowa, I'm trying to give some dimension to what we're talking about. So if you combine all the federal, state, county lands altogether, you're looking at a square 32 miles on a side. But let's just look at state parks. Let's look at what we considered the cream of the crop, and we decided right off to save. So we look at that 9 mile square, and we have, you know, hundreds of miles of roads in there. We have parking lots, showers, artificial lakes, nature centers, sewage lagoons. I mean, when you look at that square and you start taking out what's in there, what's been changed and everything, you know, we're down to a very extremely small part that has any biological integrity left. And then when you look at these areas are spread across the state in isolated little islands where there's hardly any flow of biological life between them, you know, then we're really looking at things dropping quite rapidly and maintaining. So that's where it gets difficult, I think, for, you know, in how we value these public areas. What is the value of them? Is it, do we have to have a relationship with them directly to value them? And I think the way to look at that is on a national level, on the surveys, you know, people support the national parks and everything, and most all of them don't go there for the national parks, but they still support them because they understand there's something intrinsic in that area. It represents something to us. And I think that's more what we need to talk about now because we have so little left. Instead of talking about recreation, we need to be talking about, you know, biologically, what does this serve? Because Iowa really works as a roadblock between the flow of genetic material across this landscape, say from Missouri to Minnesota, say, for example. And we look at some species. We look at migrating species such as the lesser scaup duck, the most common diving duck in North America, and it can't fly across the state without losing so much body weight that it can't reproduce or starves to death. So, I mean, their numbers are plummeting, going down. So there's something that can't get across the state because our water quality has become so bad. And the things that they need to eat are not in that water. So I think, you know, those public lands become extremely important. We're looking at that in terms of monarchs. Now we're trying to establish little islands for the monarchs to hop along through this, you know, agricultural landscape. And it's species are dropping like crazy. So,
And Mark, I think some of what you're talking about is not only is it important to have public lands to help do that because – you know, our agricultural lands, which is 90% of Iowa, is in some form of agriculture. And then you take out our cities and roads and things like that, we're left with what's the number, 1% of public land? Yeah. Having those biological communities, it's important to have those on public and private lands. Mm. But the private lands tend to not always be there. You know, you might you see a lot of agricultural lands going into the Conservation Reserve Program for 10, 15 years. Then it comes back out again. So you've lost all that habitat, and then it gets farmed and for a few years. And so it's not consistent, and it's not steady. So it's important to have both from a biological standpoint. From a human standpoint, the parks do provide those areas where we can get out and enjoy nature. Just when you were talking about the national parks, it reminded me of the day after 9/11, back in 2001, the National Park System had the largest visitors use of history that day, the day after 9/11. So put an economic value on that. You can't. There's the intrinsic value, why these places are important, why nature is important to us as humans. So we need that as well as the lesser scaup, which dies coming across Iowa because there's no food to eat.
Yeah, I hate stressing that, but I'm trying to show that, you know, how this landscape, we're talking about trails, but trails are more than trails for people. Trails are corridors for this flow of, and especially if climate change is coming and things are changing so much, that flow there has to be some way for those species to move across this landscape.
Yeah, it's like if we were to try to drive from California to New York, and have no restaurants.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
Okay. Well, you mentioned private land, Lisa, and that's a large part of what your organization does, right? The Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation.
Sure. Well, you know, we talk about the loss of public land and how little we have, and we're a nonprofit, and we work with landowners and public agencies to help protect land. Over the last 30 years, we've helped protect about 150,000 acres now. So, I mean, people do want to see land protected. A lot of the land that we've protected has gone into public ownership to county conservation boards, cities. Here in Ames, Munn Woods is a prime example that we acquired and then raised funds around and transferred it to the city. And then private landowners are protecting their land through conservation easements. So it remains in private ownership, but the work that they have done to protect it and restore it, if it's a woodland, a prairie, wetland, things like that, the easement ensures that it will stay that way. So it's private protection, but yet you're ensuring the land use does not change.
Can you describe that process a little more in detail? So if a landowner has nurtured the land back mm-hmm. to something like its original state mm-hmm. and is, getting, in his mm-hmm. his in her 60s or 70s and knowing that this is, mm-hmm. This is something they want to maintain. What do they do exactly?
The first thing is we have a booklet called the Landowner's Options. And they could start by taking a look at that and seeing what their choices are for long-term conservation, whether or not they want to own it and pass it on to their children, or maybe they don't have heirs and want to find a home for it in the long term. So there's different methods about protecting land. And they can call us and we can help them walk through that process. We may be the best organization for them. We might work with a county with that landowner. It really depends on the land and the needs and the needs of the landowner. So
and
it's
then
a conversation that needs to happen.
Uh-huh. And then a conservation easement is.
Yes. Yeah, that's one of the options. So it's an agreement between Iowa has in the Iowa State Code, there's several organizations can hold easements, nonprofits, public agencies, soil districts. And so that's an agreement. It's a legal agreement, and it runs with the land. And the agreement spells out what those land uses can and can't be. For example, no mining, no clear cutting. There may be some agriculture. We have a lot of working land, so agriculture with a conservation plan and maybe some additional restoration work, things like that. Probably housing is restricted, or maybe there's a little house in the corner or something. It varies. It depends on the land, the needs of the land and the needs of the landowner.
So the landowner can go ahead and sell the land, but the person who buys the land is agreeing to mm-hmm. do these things.
The conservation easement runs with the land title itself, so it stays there forever.
Forever.
Mm-hmm. And then our obligation, if we hold the easement, we have to monitor that easement every
right.
year. So one of the things we do is we request a donation to our easement monitoring fund so that we've got the long-term resources to have staff out there every year working with the current landowner, making sure that they understand the terms of the easement and just preventing any, violations.
And how has that been? How is it with the landowners who come in and, mm-hmm. and do these things, what is their attitude toward this? Are they generally feeling really good about their role?
Oh, absolutely. It's like you have a valued treasure and you want to know that it's got a good home, beyond your lifetime. And so it's the same thing with land.
Okay. I want to ask both of you about state funding for parks. This year's first Sunday editorial of the Des Moines Register called out the state legislature for not following up on funds for various environmental initiatives, and especially state parks. There were a lot of different initiatives discussed in that article. I just want to know, when you're talking about state funding for parks and the need for public lands to be preserved, which entity? Is it REAP? Is it the new trust fund that's been set up? Which one do you kind of focus on in terms of what our legislature needs to do?
I'd say all of them, everything,
yeah,
and as fast
them.
As possible.
But absolutely. REAP's been around for a lot of years. It's a very trusted program, but we have to fight for it every year because it gets funded at different levels. Sometimes every once in a while, once, it hasn't been funded at all. And it's an extremely important program for cities, states, counties, soil districts, conservation education. It's a fairly all-inclusive program. It's never been funded at its full level that the legislature first appropriated it at. The trust fund that we all voted on in 2010 to change the Iowa Constitution that said next time the sales tax is increased, 0.375 would go towards the outdoor trust fund. That has not happened. The point there is it's consistent. It would be consistent. We wouldn't have to fight for it every year, and folks would be able to plan their budgets based on knowing that there's a steady stream of funding for conservation. And right now, if you look at the governor's budget, the pie chart, you know, you've got your big chunk that goes towards health and human services and a large part towards education and then some other things. And, you know, environment is down there less than around 2%. I mean, a few years ago, it rounded to 0% because it was so low. So, and now they're trying to, you know, it's like he's trying to pit education against the environment. And yeah, it gets frustrating, honestly.
And actually, in the long run, the funding for conservation has continued to decrease. It's not increasing. And, I mean, that was the trouble with REAP when we Resource mm-hmm. Enhancement and Protection. It was to have money in there and build off the interest, and they never funded it.
Right.
And we have a long history of passing environmental things to address things, REAP and this mm-hmm. new thing. But when you really look at it, no funding goes to those. So, like in 1987, I think the legislature passed a bill and said because we were the lowest of public land, and they realized this, so they said we needed public land, and we want to shoot for 10% of Iowa should be under public protection. Well, here we are today, and we're still looking at the 1% and 2% mm-hmm. level. So things haven't changed because there was no follow-through with that. And that's, I think, true of REAP and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, like you say, how can you budget when you don't know how much money you're going to get again? Mm-hmm. How can you plan long-term under those kind of circumstances?
Okay. Bringing it back to the Bundy Clan, Mark Edwards.
I got a notice. I follow these different environmental organizations, and they were saying, you know, who's a more threat to public land? You know, these people are like in the Southwest now. They're talking of clear-cutting a space the size of Vermont, okay, of pinyon trees, old-growth pinyon trees in the Southwest, okay. And that's the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, going to do that. So it's, to me, when I'm looking at the landscape from a biologic perspective, you know, we can do as much damage in government. And that's, I think, you know, ironic for what they're saying out there, the people doing this occupation is saying they want to take it for private use. But we're going to do this down in the Southwest to improve cattle grazing on public lands. And we also look at there's an increase going on of drilling mineral rights on public land. You know, there's a vast expansion. So, you know, how are we going to talk about this public land? Is it for our use, our resources? Is that the bottom line? Or is it for a larger picture, you know, the health of the whole landscape? And that's the discussion we need to be having. You know, and it's too bad it comes down to money. Because it isn't about money anymore. It's so far beyond money. I mean, when you're down to if you've used 98% of your landscape for agriculture or whatever in cities and roads, you know, you're way off. There's no compromising left anymore when you're down to that scale because things aren't functioning on that level.
Right. And ultimately, it does affect humanity.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I hope you'll stick around for my conversation with Mary Skopek, and we're going to listen to some music right now.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream War. This land was made for you and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of a diamond dance. And all around me a voice was sad. This land was made for you and me.
Perfect.
All right. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts today, Greta Anderson, together with Ursula Rudenberg. And according to the Office of Ag Secretary Bill Northey, last month was the wettest December on record, with about 5 inches of rain, a huge jump over the previous record for rain of 3.7 inches. That was December rain record. There were a couple of notable storms that brought flooding in this part of the state especially. And we at KHOI wanted to know how these unprecedented rains and their timing affected water quality around the state. So we are on the phone with Mary Skopek, Iowa DNR Water Monitoring Staff. Mary, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. So DNR has you listed as the beach monitoring coordinator. In the past, you've been the state contact for the Iowa Water Volunteer Water Quality Monitoring as well.
Yes, and I coordinate the stream monitoring program as well. So I do a number of things for Iowa DNR.
Okay. So basically, you keep an eye on water quality around the state. My first question is how does heavy rain affect nutrient levels in our waters? Is there like a dilution effect with all of that water coming into the streams, or does the rain exacerbate nutrient runoff and leaching?
So the way nutrients get into the water, there's a couple of different ways. One is if it directly runs over the surface. And so if we have heavy rainfall events, like we saw in December, the rain will pick up dirt. And if that dirt has nutrients like phosphorus on that dirt, it'll wash it into the stream, and we'll see a big increase as a result of those rains. Or if there's bacteria on that dirt, as well gets washed into the stream pretty rapidly in very big numbers. The other way nutrients can get into the water is through shallow groundwater flow. So if that rain gets into the soil, it'll start to leach or pick up those nutrients that are in that soil profile and be delivered either through shallow groundwater or through tiles. And with that particular mechanism of nutrients getting into the water, heavy rain, we see a big decrease or dilution, like you said, initially, but then we see an increase over the next 24 to 48 hours in nutrients. And so it's kind of a quick drop and then a really high rising level of nutrients when it's coming through those tile lines.
Okay. And we've all been taught to call these nutrients, which is a bit of a euphemism. They're really pollutants, right? We're talking about nitrogen, which harms human health as well as environmental health.
Yeah, so we call them nutrients because when they're on the crop land, they're providing nutrients to plants that were the crops that we're trying to grow. Once they reach the stream, they're no longer really useful for crop land, and so they become a pollutant that the stream is then having to deal with those levels of nitrogen, phosphorus. So it's a little bit of a context question. So where is that compound? Is that on the farmland or in the water? And certainly we don't want nitrogen and phosphorus in the water because it can have adverse impacts.
Okay, and nitrogen is the one that we've been talking about a lot lately, especially in terms of the tiles and the struggles of the Des Moines Water Works to keep up with nitrogen levels. Can you be specific about what you saw in nitrogen levels this December across the state?
Sure. So we monitor about 60 stations around the state of Iowa. These are stream stations, excuse me, that we take samples in the streams and look for nitrogen. And when we compare 2015 to the previous 15 years of December data, we saw about a doubling of nitrate in 2015 in those December results compared to that long-term kind of average level. So certainly this was a very unusual December with respect to those nitrogen levels. And again, that's kind of your average or median concentration. So there were levels that were even higher than that, but we did see about a doubling of where we normally are at this time of year.
Wow. And then one of my big concerns, is the field right across from my property in rural Story County. It was spread with hog manure this November for the first time. We have a new hog confinement in the neighborhood, and so this field got its first baptism. And November is the time when all the hog confinements typically empty their lagoons because the crop is gone. The manure is supposed to be knifed into the ground before the ground freezes. So, like, November is the month to spread your manure. And then when we had that first really sustained torrential rainfall in December, the creek jumped its banks and climbed 10, 20 yards into this field and sat there for days, pooling all the runoff from higher up before it returned to its banks. So, of course, I wasn't really, you know, thrilled back in November when the manure spread. But in December, when that all happened, I felt sick just looking at that and thinking of what was happening to my creek and all the creeks around the rivers and rivers around the state. Are there any indicators in your data of the contribution of hog manure that are reflected in the December data?
So we did see, when we look at the data, the levels of bacteria, for example, in Iowa streams was much higher in 2015 in December compared again to that long-term average. It was about 10 times higher than we normally see in December. We normally would expect bacteria levels to start to drop in the winter months, partly because it's colder, so the bacteria that get into the stream aren't as able to hang on cold conditions for them. And then also, again, we tend not to have the mechanisms that would move that bacteria from the landscape into the stream. And so we did see, like I said, about 10 times higher levels of bacteria than we normally see in December. We also saw very high levels of what we call total suspended solids. So solids are anything from dirt to, again, organic matter. Anything that's basically a solid particle that gets washed into the stream. And again, we saw very high levels of total suspended solids in December. Again, about a doubling of what we have seen over the long-term average. And then the last thing that we saw was very high levels of total phosphorus. So phosphorus can either be in total form, it's organic phosphorus, or it's sort of soluble or dissolved phosphorus. When we look at all those forms of phosphorus together, we call that total phosphorus. And that was, again, much higher in December than we've seen in typical Decembers. And again, you know, the sources of that can be, you know, organic matters from manures, but it can be, again, sediments as well. And we aren't able to really distinguish that when we get that result back from the lab, but certainly indicating that we saw much, you know, different conditions that we normally see in December with water quality. So a very unusual late winter or late fall, early winter here.
And why isn't this in the news? I mean, we here at KHOI, we're talking about it, but I haven't seen this in the papers.
Well, I can't give you a good example of why that would be. I think there's a lot of focus right now on the nitrate issue. And certainly there's been discussion about the levels of nitrate that are elevated. And the drinking water aspect of nitrate is certainly something that captures the attention of people. I don't really know why folks aren't talking more about what we've seen in December here with some of the other issues going on. Yeah, it's certainly the nitrate issue has certainly captured the attention with the lawsuit. But we've seen some other things going on this fall that also are things to be thinking about.
Right. 10 times higher the bacteria count than. You can't blame that on the migrating geese.
Probably not on the migrating geese. And, you know, it's certainly unusual when we see those levels of bacteria at this time of year. And it was a warmer December than typical. So it wasn't an especially cold December, but those levels were much, much higher this year.
Right. So, Mary, there has been a lot of talk about how to improve water quality. What can be done and what is being done?
Based on the data that I've seen, one of the most, encouraging practices that's out there is really cover crop, because it provides a number of benefits. Everything from that crop that is growing is pulling nutrients out of the soil and essentially locking that nutrient into the plant material itself. So this year, when we have a very warm fall, if you don't have anything growing on that landscape, essentially the nutrients, when that rain hits the soil, it's again leaching, dissolving, pulling those nutrients out and delivering them through tile flow or through stream flow, groundwater flow to the stream. So that cover crop really helps to lock those nutrients onto the landscape and also slows the amount of water that's flowing off that landscape. So it provides a bit of a friction aspect. So when the water is moving over the land, it can't just erode the soil that's there. And it helps that water infiltrate into the ground, which is better than having that water just slicing over that landscape and picking up soil and bacteria and nutrients and that kind of thing. So when I think about things that widespread use of cover crops would provide a really big benefit for the state of Iowa, and some of the data coming out of Iowa State and other researchers are that we do see about a 50% reduction in some of those cases of nutrients, nitrate in particular, being lost from those grounds that have cover crops. So for me, I think about having something that's a landscape-wide practice. There are a number of other practices that can be applied as well, things like a bioreactor that treats that tile water before it enters the stream. But those tend to be sort of what we call end-of-pipe solutions. And so the water's got to go through the landscape and then it gets sort of scrubbed before it comes into the stream. But in times of very high rainfall events, a lot of that water gets bypassed because if it went through the bioreactor, it would essentially blow out that bioreactor. So we really need landscape-level practices to really help slow that water down, do more of that treatment on every single acre of landscape. Those are hard things to get going in certain areas, partly because, you know, people have to invest money to do that every single year. It's not a practice that you buy and then you're essentially done with it for the next 15 years. So you have to reinvest every year. And so that's going to really take some big changes in how we think about agricultural production, I think.
Hmm. All right. Thank you so much, Mary, for sharing this really important information with us. We have to move on to other issues. We've been talking with Mary Skopek, Iowa DNR Water Quality Monitoring Team.
Oh, when the sun came shining and I was strolling and the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling as the fog was lifting, a voice was chanting, this land was made for you and me. And as I went walking, I saw a sign there, and on the sign it said no trespassing, but on the other sign it didn't say nothing. That sign was made for you and me. In the shadow of steeple, I saw my people by the early forfeits. I see my people as they stood there hungry. I'm still there asking, is this land made for you and me? Or nobody living can ever stop me as I go. That freedom highway, nobody living can make me feel that. This land was made for you and me.
Next in the studio, we have Leanne Harder. Leanne keeps us updated on the county and what's going on. Welcome back to you, Leanne. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Good morning.
And this is the New Year, and Leanne, so one of the things that people always associate with years are budgets. The budget cycle for the county starts on July 1st, right?
We do. Our budget year, like many local governments, runs a fiscal year, and it's a July through a June budget.
However, now starting in January, you're going to be starting to look at the budget and prepare for it. Is that correct?
We do. We're starting to prepare. We actually start back in November. November last year, we kind of kicked it off with departments putting some preliminary figures together. The Board of Supervisors last week, though, started meeting with all the different departments and elected offices to have their budget hearings or budget meetings. Those meetings are an opportunity for the board to meet with departments, figure out what the budget requests are going to be, make some priorities, put some preliminary figures down. And the process are many hours of meetings and review.
But maybe the important thing here is that these are open meetings, and so the public, you are invited as a member of Story County, if you are a member of Story County,
yes,
to attend these meetings, listen to what's going on, and not only do you have the opportunity to go to the meetings, you can also hear what's happening through audio transcripts that are being made available. Is that right?
You're right. All meetings of the Board of Supervisors are public meetings. There's a schedule on the county's website of when all those meetings occur. They're all in the public meeting room in Nevada, which is the old courthouse in downtown Nevada. And the recorded sessions are in MP3 format. They're on the county's website. You go to Board of Supervisors and Budget, and you can find them there.
And the website is storycountyiowa.gov.
It is.
Right?
Thank you.
Okay, so budgets are underway, and this is a process that you as a citizen, if you live in Story County, can witness and give feedback?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about winter in Story County.
It is cold outside today in Story County.
It has arrived, and that involves maintenance, right? So talk to us a little bit about what happens in the winter in the county.
Story County Secondary Roads, through our engineer and our county engineer, maintains all those roads that are not owned by the state or the federal government, so Interstate 35, Highway 30, et cetera. Secondary Roads would like to just remind all Story County residents how roads are maintained. There's a protocol that they follow,
okay,
and they have to follow that to make sure that their budget is being held accountable and they can provide the top-notch service that they want to for citizens. They have a set of steps that they've put together, a maintenance protocol, if you will, that I'll just quickly run through.
Please do.
Okay. First of all, county roads, so these are those gravel roads out there primarily, are going to be maintained to the best of our ability, subject to all weather conditions, available equipment, and safety of personnel while trying to keep within the budget. I think that's very important. At no time, I think, should citizens be expecting the safety of anyone to be compromised unless it's a life and death situation to get access to a property. Snow is placed in the shoulder or ditch, which may actually limit some site conditions in some cases. Fortunately, we have not had the snow event like many have experienced on the East Coast last year where we have feet upon feet upon feet of snow.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had that, there could be a time where the roads start getting more narrow. So people be aware of that. And that snow plows are not normally in operation between 7 p.m. and 5 a.m.
Okay.
Unless for some reason it's an emergency,
mm-hmm,
to get and keep wind drifts. Private drives are not plowed. Those are those private driveways that go to your house or, you know, my house, whatever it may be. And this is a big one. Mailboxes may be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. By the snowplow.
The maintenance procedure says it will be replaced by the county with a normal small-sized galvanized mailbox. The property owner is responsible, however, for installing the mailbox. I'm sure all the secondary roads crew take a lot of pride in saying we don't destroy mailboxes, but those plows are very big.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very adept at driving them, but snow conditions vary from time to time. And I know mailboxes do get destroyed on occasion.
Now, if a mailbox gets destroyed by snow flying from the snowplow, do you replace them then as well?
I think it's under the same procedure.
Mm-hmm.
I think it, and that's a question I might have to follow up on and get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the plow hitting it or the snow flying is the difference. But I think I've heard in past it's one and the same.
Okay.
Emergency situations, if for some reason there's a probable loss of life or a plow needs to get back into this road, they will go beyond those hours. Traffic signs are missing or destroyed. So if someone gets in an accident and they take down a traffic sign, We're not always out there on every road to see that's been destroyed. We ask that those get called into the Story County Sheriff's Office at 515-382-6566. That's just their normal dispatch number.
Could you repeat that number?
Yep, 515-382-6566. Now, of course, if it's an emergency situation and you're there and you hit that sign and you need someone to call, come out there right now for life and death situation, call 911.
What would be an emergency situation?
Again, if you're out there and you've had a bad car accident, mm-hmm. and you need to, you say, I've just seen the 190, you're calling in to report 911. Mm-hmm. I see the 190th sign is down, mm-hmm. if it's part of that 911 call.
Okay. And we're speaking with Leanne Harder from Story County, who is checking in for a monthly check-in just for news from Story County and just kind of keeping updated on life in the county, things that are currently of concern. And it is winter, so we're talking about possible problems out on the roads. And you do have a 24-hour crisis phone line. And what is this phone line used for?
This is part of the regionalization of mental health for Story County. This is a new 24-hour crisis phone line through the Central Iowa Community Services region. That's for the counties of Boone, Franklin, Hamilton, Hardin, Jasper, Madison, Marshall, Poweshiek, Story, and Warren.
This is a crisis line for Central Iowa,
right.
And when should people use this crisis line?
It provides information to access any emergency services in times of crisis, behavioral services, outpatient mental health services.
So this is a crisis line, a mental health crisis line, for problems with somebody having a mental health crisis?
Right.
And when you say emergency services, you're referring to hospital, police?
All in the above.
All in the above?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is a new service that Story County is pleased to be a member of and mm-hmm. be able to offer. Mental health throughout the state of Iowa has been going through some adaptations with the regionalization.
Right. And what happens when you call this number?
This goes to Foundation 2. That is the name of the company that is managing the calls. They have the appropriate service providers on the other end of the call, and then they are able to send it through the emergency channels if needed, get local law enforcement or the hospital involved if needed.
So in other words, somebody will answer the phone and help you figure out what emergency service you need.
Yeah.
And then we'll call those for you.
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
That number is 844-258-8858. And I'll say that again.
Yeah, repeat that number.
It's 844-258-8858.
And again, this is a 24-hour emergency crisis line for mental health problems.
Right.
And if you have a crisis, either yourself or somebody in your family or somebody in public, you can call this number and somebody will help you sort out what to do and what kind of help you need.
Mm-hmm. And we do have little note cards at the county. If anyone would like to contact me, we can get those to that individual to help them distribute. It's a very important phone number to help share.
Is there somewhere online where this phone number can be found?
It's on our county's website, too, which is storycountyiowa.gov.
So that might be a good number to write down somewhere in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's 844-258-8858. Okay, before we end today, let's talk a little bit about E911. What is E911?
E911, if you are a rural resident in Story County out in unincorporated areas, that is emergency 911. That's our road system, but it's also our addressing system. It's that blue marker that is placed in the driveway with anywhere from 4 to 5 white digits on your address marker. That is how the county and emergency service providers can locate your property when you call 911 or someone calls 911 and asks for assistance. Those markers were put in the mid-1990s for the most part, and they are really starting to age.
And they are on the ground?
They're on a post.
Uh-huh.
And that post is placed into the ground on the edge of the driveway. And then they're attached and kind of stick out on horizontally to the a 90-degree angle to your post.
And again, the purpose of these markers is to allow emergency service people to know where you are?
It is. I mean, obviously, it's, if you have a delivery from UPS or something, they can use that to locate you. But the primary purpose that Story County used to install these blue markers, as have many counties in Iowa, is for emergency service location. So we're asking those individuals to just that live in rural unincorporated Story County, look at your address marker, see what the condition is it in. Is it visible at night? Is it visible during the day? Are the numbers peeling off? Is the sign bent? Is there any maintenance that needs to be done?
And this is for your own safety.
For your own safety, exactly. There is a cost that will go with it if we need to replace it. And we're just asking you to take time to assess the condition of your address marker. If it's in really bad condition, let the planning and development staff know at Story County. And you may call them at 515-382-7245.
Say that again?
515-382-7245.
Okay. Okay, Leanne, anything else before we wrap up?
Yes. Just really quickly, I want to tell people of upcoming public input opportunities.
Okay, great.
For the Cornerstone to Capstone plan, the C2C plan. All the chapters for the draft plan are now on the website. So you go to c2cplan.com, which is c2cplan.com. And we're asking people for input. Those will be actually sent out via social media, kind of chapter by chapter, starting this week, too. So there's an opportunity to provide input that way. But we'll have public open houses on January 19th, which will be at Dakin's Community Center in Zeering, January 21st in Maxwell at the Legion Hall, January 26th at McFarland Park, so Story County Conservation Headquarters, January 28th at the Slater Elementary School in Slater, and finally, right here in Ames on February 2nd at the Public Library.
And what happens at these open houses?
We're first of all going to have opportunity for people just to look at the different maps and different goals that Story County has come up with, and then have a brief presentation from part of our consultant. And just really the focus is to get input from the general public. Are we on the right track with what the draft plan is looking at like right now? We really are in the final 6 months of that plan.
And this is the long-range plan for Story County.
Plan, right.
And this is still an opportunity for you to give input, to find out what the county's doing. And, yeah, let's talk about that at length next month when you come in, because that's our future, right?
It is. It's our next 20, 30 years plan. And actually next month we'll have a good sense of where we are from the public input, too.
Okay, very exciting. And there's a list of these open houses, again, at your website?
Yep, on our website and at c2cplan.com.
Okay. Thank you, Leanne.
Thank you.
Always appreciate you coming in and giving us an update, and look forward to hearing more about the C2C plan next month.
I will. I'll be back next month. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Ursula Rudenberg. We started out the show with Mark Edwards, retired trails coordinator for the Iowa DNR, and Lisa Hine of Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, talking about land in Iowa that is being preserved for reasons of biological integrity. We then spoke with Mary Skopek, a member of the Iowa DNR's water quality monitoring staff, about the dramatic effects of the unprecedented heavy rains last month. Finally, we spoke with Leanne Harder, outreach coordinator for county government in Story County.
Local Talk is recorded at 7 a.m. and rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to us on the radio or with our live stream at khoifm.org. You can listen online at khoifm.org. Later in the day, we'll also post information about our guests along with relevant links that you heard about on today's show. Again, that's at khoifm.org. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, for making all of that possible.
And if you missed it this Saturday, don't forget to check out KHOI's first national broadcast, a candidate forum held by Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, broadcast on our station and distributed to other stations nationwide through the Pacifica Radio Network. Links to that show will also be on our website, khoifm.org.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter Or perhaps if you'd like to try your hand as an engineer, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoyfm.org.
Local Talk was ably engineered by Nadia Abdelazim. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was This Land Is Your Land, performed by My Morning Jacket.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. And remember, as always, your participation as the listener are what makes KHOI possible, as well as your generous contributions. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.